Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
You listen to me. I want you to let the people that are landing take those Outlander children with them.
I'm not gonna let the honor of our name be smirched because you got yourself caught like a yellow dog. If they wanna fight, they can have it.
Contact! We are being fired upon. Say again, we are receiving hostile fire.
Graphic Audio presents The Serrano Legacy by Elizabeth Moon.
What's wrong?
There have been complications. And Admiral Serrano's grandson is down there.
All they've got is old-fashioned small arms and big knives.
Major, it could be a lot worse than that. These guys may have our missing nukes.
Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Elizabeth Demery, M.B. Van Dorn, Corey James, Peter Stray, Sonny Lasky, Sherry Simpson, Lily Beacon, Stephen Carpenter, Michael John Casey, Elizabeth Jernigan, Michael Glenn, Thomas Penny, Jeff Baker, Karen Carbone, Colleen Delaney, Tim Getman, James Lewis, David Coyne, James Konacek, Tom Simpson, Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Kate Foster, and Chris Rowan. Book 5, Rules of Engagement, Part 2.
The Admiral wants you.
Esme Suiza looked up from her lists at the jig in the doorway. She hadn't done something wrong again, surely.
On my way.
Whatever it was, a bad attitude wouldn't make it any better. In Admiral Hornan's outer office, the clerk nodded at her soberly and touched a button on the desk.
Go right in, Lieutenant Suiza.
So it was serious, and she still had no idea what was going on. They had chewed all the flavor out of her sins so far. What else was there to attack? She met Admiral Hornan's eyes squarely.
Lieutenant Suiza, reporting, sir.
At ease, Lieutenant. I'm sorry to say I have sad news for you. We have received a request relayed by Ansible from your father for you to take emergency leave. Your great-grandmother has died.
Esme felt her knees give a little.
Sit down, Lieutenant.
Esme sat, her mind whirling.
Would you like tea? Coffee?
No. Thank you, sir. I'll be fine in a moment.
Your father indicates that you and your great-grandmother were close.
Yes, sir.
And says that your presence is urgently needed for both legal and family matters, if you can possibly be spared. Under the circumstances, I think you certainly can be spared. Your presence here is hardly essential.
He might as well have said it was grossly unwelcome. Esme registered that, but felt none of the pain she would have felt before. Great-grandmother had been a constant, even in self-exile, all Esme's life, all her father's life.
Thank you, sir.
I'm curious to know, if you would not mind telling me, what legalities might require a great-grandchild's presence at such a time.
Esme dragged her mind back to the present conversation. She felt she was wading through glue.
I'm not entirely sure, sir. Unless I am my great-grandmother's nearest female relative in the female line, and I'd have thought it was my Aunt Sanibel.
I don't follow.
It's the land, sir. The estancia. Land passes in the female line.
Land? How much land?
Sir, I'm sorry, but I don't know. A lot?
10 hectares? 100?
Oh, no, much more than that. The headquarters buildings occupy 20 hectares, and the polo fields are probably 100 hectares there. Most of the small paddocks up by the house are 50 hectares.
A small paddock, just part of this land, is 50 hectares?
Yes, and the large pastures for the cattle are anywhere from 1 to 3,000 hectares.
All right, a lot of land. Lieutenant, does anyone in the fleet know that you are that rich?
Rich?
You don't consider thousands of hectares a sign of wealth?
I never really thought of it, sir. It's not mine. I mean, it never was. And I'm reasonably sure it's not now. It's the family's.
My retirement estate is 10 hectares.
Esme could think of nothing to say but sorry, and she knew that was wrong.
So might I conclude that if you were to choose to pursue family responsibilities rather than a career in fleet, you would not be starving in the street somewhere?
Sir?
Not that I'm advising you to do so. I merely find it interesting that the young officer who was capable of telling the speaker's daughter she was a spoiled rich girl is herself a rich girl. A very rich girl. Perhaps for all the reasons you elucidated for Sarah Meager's benefit, rich girls are not suited to military careers.
It was as close to an instruction to resign as anyone could come without saying the words. Esme met his eyes, bleak misery in her heart. The Admiral looked down at his desk.
Your leave and travel orders have been cut, Lieutenant Sweezer. Be sure to take all the time you need.
She would be polite, no matter what.
Thank you, sir.
Dismissed.
The clerk looked up as she came out.
Bad news, sir?
My great-grandmother died. Head of the family.
I'm sorry, sir. I have the leave and travel orders the Admiral told me to prepare. You've got a level 2 priority, and I took the liberty of putting your name on a berth for the fastest transit I could find.
Thank you. That's very kind.
You're quite welcome, sir. Just sorry it's for a sad occasion. I notice your end of leave is given as indeterminate. I'm assuming you'll notify the nearest Sector HQ when you know how long you'll need.
That's right.
That would be Sector 9, and I'll just add the recognition codes you'll need. And here you are, sir.
Thank you. Again.
Esme managed a genuine smile for the clerk. He, at least, treated her as if she were a normal person worth respect. Her transport would undock in 6 hours. She hurried back to her quarters to pack. Marta Caterina Saenz, chairholder in her own right and voter of 2 other chairs in the family sept, had been expecting the summons for weeks before it came. Bunny's wild daughter had at last fallen into more trouble than Youth and Dash could get her out of, though the news media had been fairly vague about what it was, having had her listed first as missing and then as presumed captured by pirates. She suspected it might be worse than that. Pirates normally killed any captives or ransomed them quickly. Bunny, who had succeeded Chemtree as the chief executive of the Familius Grand Council, had actually done quite well in the various crises that had followed the king's abdication. But rumor had it that his daughter's disappearance had sent him into a state close to unreason. Rumor was usually wrong in details, Marta had found, but right in essence. She herself was the logical person to call in for advice and help. Family connections and cross-connections, for one thing, and, paradoxically, her reputation for avoiding the hurly-burly of political life. Several of the families had already contacted her, asking her to make discreet inquiries. Moreover, she had helped Bunny in the Patchcock affair, and she knew the redoubtable Admiral Serrano. In addition, whatever trouble Brunn had gotten herself into involved this side of Familius space. That was clear from the number of increased fleet patrols and the way her own carriers were being stopped for inspection. So it was natural that someone would think of asking her to, what was the phrase, assist in the investigations. She did not resent the call as much as she might have a decade or so earlier. That affair on Patchcock had been much more fun than she'd expected, and the aftermath, when she'd tackled Rafaela's difficult mother about the girl's marriage, even more so. Perhaps she'd had enough, for a while, of secluded mountain estates and laboratory research. Perhaps it was time for another fling. Though, by all accounts, this would be no fling. When she boarded the RSS Gazehound, which had been sent to fetch her, she was given a data cube which made that clear. Marta had met Brunn more than once in her wildest stages, and the vid of Brunn helpless and mute was worse than shocking. Captain Bonniers had welcomed her aboard with the grave deference due her age and rank. Marta had managed not to chuckle aloud at that point, but it wasn't easy. He seemed so young, and his crew were mere children. But of course they weren't. Still, they responded to her as her many nieces and nephews had, treating her as an honorary grandmother. For the price of listening to the same old stories of love, betrayal, and reconciliation, she could acquire vast amounts of information the youngsters never knew they were giving away. By the end of the 21-day voyage, she was remembering exactly why she normally lived in isolation. People told her things. They always had. And after just a few weeks of it, she felt stuffed with the innumerable details of their lives and feelings. Therapist had never been her favorite self-definition. Marta prepared herself for her first meeting with Bunny. She knew, from the tension all around her, that whether she liked it or not, she was everyone's favorite candidate for therapist where Bunny was concerned. She swept into the room with her usual flair, hoping it would have its usual effect on him. This time it did not. Lord Thornbuckle looked up at her with the expression of a man very near the edge of sanity. Desperate, exhausted. Not the expression one wanted to see on the chief executive of the Familius Regnant. Someone on whose judgment the security of the entire empire depended. Marta moderated her instinctive verve and instead walked quietly across the room to take the hand he held out to her.
Bunny, I'm so sorry.
Bunny stared at her silently.
But I know Brunn, and if she's alive, we can and will help her.
You don't know what they did to her. My daughter.
She did know, but clearly he needed to tell her.
Tell me.
And she held his hand through the recitation of all the horrors he knew Brunn had endured, and the ones that might have followed. She interrupted this latter list.
You can't know that. You can't know. And until we know for certain, you must not waste your strength worrying about it.
Easy for you to say.
It was my niece you sent off to rescue Ronnie and George. It is not easy to say or to do, but people of our rank have responsibilities. Yours is heavy, but not beyond your strength. If you will quit adding to the load by imagining even more horrors.
But Brunn...
What you are doing by tearing yourself up does not help her.
I don't know what to do.
Where's Miranda?
She's back on Castle Rock.
Bunny's exquisitely beautiful wife was, under her beauty, a woman of spun steel endurance, capable of enforcing sense on her husband, one of the few who could.
I didn't want her out here.
Then in her place, I will tell you what to do. Eat a hot meal. Sleep at least 9 hours. Eat another hot meal. Don't talk to anyone about anything important until you have done so. You will be even more miserable if your bad judgment, born of hunger and exhaustion, harms Brunn's chances.
But I can't just sleep.
Then get medication. Bunny, I'm terribly, terribly sorry that this has happened. But you simply must not go into this as you are.
Who called you here?
It doesn't matter. I'm here. I belong here because those people are only a jump point away from my home. And I'm taking charge of you at this moment, because I'm older, meaner, and you daren't hit me.
With that, she punched in a call to the infirmary and the kitchen, and stood over Bunny until he had downed a bowl of soup and a plate of chicken and rice. Then she insisted that he take the medication provided, and nodded to his valet.
Don't let him up until morning, or he slept 10 hours, whichever comes latest. Then make him eat again.
From the startled but relieved expressions of those around her, Marta judged that no one else had been able to make the speaker see reason. He was, after all, the speaker of the Grand Council. She felt her lip curling. That was exactly why she let someone else vote her seat most of the time. All this ridiculous social etiquette getting in the way of common sense. Her next stop was a brief call on Admiral Serrano, who was said to be in line to command the task force. On her way through the interminable wave of military bureaucracy, she saw a sleek, blonde female officer talking to another woman.
Well, it was Sweezer, after all.
Both shook their heads. Marta decided she didn't like the sleek blonde, on no more evidence than the unlikely perfection of her bone structure and perfect grooming. She filed the comment away. Vita Serrano looked almost as harried and exhausted as Thornbuckle had. Marta blinked. She had not expected this.
What happened to you?
Lord Thornbuckle, He's furious with the Serrano family in general, and me in particular.
Why?
Because he thinks it was his daughter's attachment to my niece Harris which led her into what he calls dangerous interests. Of course, there was that regrettable incident at Xavier, but it certainly wasn't Harris's fault. Then I recommended that she go to the fleet training facility at Copper Mountain to get some practical knowledge, and I had hoped some discipline as well, but that blew up in our faces when she was shot at, then quarreled with Lieutenant Suiza and stormed off on her own. Still, it was my recommendation, so it's my fault. I really had thought she was ready for something like Copper Mountain. Lord Thornbuckle himself introduced his daughter to Lieutenant Suiza, but apparently that young woman is not at all what she seemed.
I am confused. I thought young Brunn had managed to get herself captured by pirates and hauled off somewhere. I saw the vid of her mutilation, that's all. But I've heard nasty comments about Lieutenant Suiza from more than one person. And this is the first I've heard of Brunn taking any military training. And shot at? Was that part of a course or something else?
Vida suddenly looked more like the Admiral she was.
One thing at a time. Brunn was accepted as a civilian trainee. She signed up for courses in search and rescue and similar adventurous things. I was hoping, frankly, that she'd realize how well her talent suited us and join Fleet formally.
Prune? You could no more make that girl into an officer than a mountain cat into a sheepdog.
So it seems. Perhaps she was on her best behavior with me. At any rate, while she was there, she was the target of at least two assassination attempts, one nearly fatal, in part because she insisted on doing what everyone else did and eluding her assigned security detail. Her father wanted her to leave, and she refused. He recognized Lieutenant Suiza from all the publicity and tried to enlist her help in making his daughter cooperate with her security detail. Apparently, his daughter did agree, and things went along fairly well for a few weeks. Witnesses say that she kept trying to make friends with Suiza, who wasn't willing.
Why?
Who can know? She was taking extra courses herself, doubling up, but all we know for sure is that she and Brunn quarreled the night before the field exercise in escape and evasion. Lieutenant Suiza was extremely rude and abusive. I've heard the tapes myself. And according to some sources, she had been previously heard to make disparaging remarks about the senior families and the Grand Council. Highly unprofessional.
Why didn't this come out at the time of the court's martial? Surely if she'd had a bad reputation, it would have been a matter of some interest during the investigation of the mutiny.
I don't know. I wasn't involved in that investigation, except in the most preliminary stages. All the background work was done at headquarters. Frankly, I had trouble believing that of her. I'd met her several times, you know. But the scan record is undeniable. Moreover, she admits she said those things to Saramiga.
Odd.
Marta filed that away in the same mental cubbyhole as the sleek blonde's remark.
So, what happened to Brunn, then?
Vida related what was known.
We're keeping it as quiet as we can, which isn't very. The news feeds have agreed for now, but who knows when they'll change their mind. Clearly, these people want it known. They keep leaking vid and other material, everything except location, to the news feeds. Worse, we still do not know where she was taken. And until we know that, we can hardly formulate a plan to get her out. The Guernesi are cooperating in every way, but so far we're still sifting through a very large sand pile looking for one very small diamond.
Marta gazed past Vida at the wall screen, a pattern of slowly shifting bands of color.
Well, I'll tell you what I've accomplished. I put Bunny to bed with his stomach full of decent food, and I think I've terrorized the medical staff into keeping him down for at least 10 hours.
I'm impressed.
You should be. I presume you wanted me for my knowledge of the region.
Your ships travel it regularly. We wondered if there was anything in any of the logs that might reveal a trace of the ship or ships that Brunn was on.
What are we looking for?
A Boros Consortium container ship, a heavy, called the Elias Madero, perhaps traveling in association with one or more ships of about patrol class.
I presume you want this information extracted without informing my entire staff?
If possible, yes.
I'll do the data suck myself.
Marta stood up.
Now, you, my dear, need to take the same advice I gave to Bunny. A hot meal, a long sleep. For a woman your age, you look like hell.
Yes, Marta. Are we convening the aunt's coven again?
No. Cecilia would be no help on this, and her feelings for Brunn would be almost as obstructive as Bunny's. You and I should be able to handle it.
If your esteemed friend will quit putting obstacles in my path. He's so convinced there's a conspiracy of Serrano's, I'm lucky to still be on the task force.
I'll see what I can do when he's had some sleep. Now, what can you give me for doing the suck on my own database?
Well, we've gathered the best we've got. Take your pick. Here's my private list.
Vita handed over a data cube.
You might want to work through Harris. She's got the really good techs with her at the moment.
Fine. Now, what's our conference schedule?
Between meetings and a long and abortive attempt to extract data about the Boros ship from her own databases, no one had reported anything like it. Marta pottered about, as she thought of it, listening and learning how Fleet fit together. Much like any large organization, including her own pharmaceutical firms, but subtly different. Yet it was made up of people, and people were people the universe over. Take this matter of Esme Suiza. She had heard of Suiza. Everyone with a news feed had heard of Suiza, first for the Battle of Xavier and then for the Kosciusko affair. A rising young hero, a tactical genius, a charismatic leader. And she was here, executive officer of a ship in the task force. But she was not here. Nowhere in the lists of officers tasked with this or that planning was Esme Suiza listed. Her captain sat in on some meetings. She never had, it seemed. It seemed stupid. Suiza was the obvious source of recent detailed knowledge of Brunn's performance and attitudes. Surely Bunny's irrational dislike wasn't affecting everyone's judgment. Was she on some secret assignment? When she turned out to be on leave, that seemed the most likely explanation. But according to gossip, she was in disgrace and had been sent away. A cover story, of course. Marta wondered what kind of cover story they'd concocted. She knew what she would have done. She managed to be in one of the rec rooms one evening, looking by design as close to a potty old woman as she could manage, and kept her ears open. Of course, they all knew who she was, in a way. Ordinary old civilian women weren't hanging out in the junior officer's recreation room. But they all had grandmothers, and she had perfected an earthy chuckle in the years of having nieces and nephews and cousins visiting. Soon she had a circle around her, bringing her drinks and snacks and chatting happily. She didn't even have to drop the topic herself. A female ensign nudged another.
Look, there's Baron now.
They both looked, and Marta looked too. A darkly handsome, compact young man with a worried expression made his way across the room to the drinks dispenser. That same sleek blonde followed him.
With Cassie on his heels.
Lieutenant Ferrati to you, Merce. She is senior.
She is what she is.
The ensign's eyes slid to Marta, encountered the unexpected, and she blushed.
These young people so transparent.
It's a shame. I'd like to get to know him, but I can't get near him.
Well, she may be whatever, but she's better than Suiza, and that's who he was supposed to like before.
Marta gave him a smile for doing her work for her and cocked her head.
Suiza? That girl who's the hero?
Nervous glances, eyes shifting from side to side.
She's not such a hero right now, Sarah.
Why?
She said bad things about the speaker's daughter. She said she didn't deserve to be rescued.
Marta blinked. That was not the kind of cover story she would have invented, and it wasn't something Admiral Serrano had told her. She had mentioned a row at Copper Mountain, but nothing since. That kind of rumor could hang around and damage someone's career years later.
Are you sure?
Nods, some reluctant.
It started before, is what I heard.
It's all crap. I don't believe it. Someone made it up.
No, it's true. They have a tape. I heard Major Crissen talking to Commander Dodd, and he said he heard it himself. She crawled with Sarah Meager at training command. Something about a course they were both in, and they nearly asked for her commission.
I don't know what you could say bad enough for that.
Well, it had something to do with her loyalty or something.
Well, but she is a hero, isn't she? I mean, she brought her ship back and saved Xavier.
Yes, but why? That's what they're asking now. People I know who know her in the Academy said she wasn't that talented then. She wasn't even command track. How could she get that good without anyone knowing? Unless she had help. And not wanting to rescue Sarah Meager.
I'm sure she does, but nobody listens.
Just because you have a bad case of hero worship, you can't ignore the facts. Sarah Meager is a chairholder. We exist to protect chairholders and...
What class was she in?
That led to an explanation Marta did not want about the way the Academy named its classes, on a rotation having nothing to do with the standard calendar. She felt her eyes about to glaze over.
So anyway, she's in Valiant class, 6 years ago.
Marta converted that quickly to standard dates, but reminded herself that she'd probably have to ask for classmates by the fleet's peculiar reckoning. But her informant went on, clearly in earnest to be complete.
Her classmates will be Jigs. That's Lieutenant, junior grade, Sarah. And Lieutenants. Everyone who doesn't mess up badly is promoted from Ensign to Jig at the same time. But there's a selection board for Lieutenant, with a 12-month range. Lieutenant Sweeza was promoted in the first selection. Some of her classmates will be promoted in the next few days.
So, to find Esme's classmates, she could confine herself to lieutenants for the most part, and some of them promoted behind her might have reason to wish her ill. Casually, without apparent intent, Marta began trolling through the assortment of lieutenants. Most were, she found, either classmates or within 1 year of Esme Sweeza's class. Some had hardly noticed her at the academy, others claimed to have known her well. And a few had more immediate information to share, like the red-headed lieutenant with the mustache. Vericor, his name was.
I just can't believe it. I mean, Esme? Yes, she got angry, and yes, she said things she shouldn't have. But she'd been working twice as hard as anyone else. They should have cut her some slack. You'd have thought she murdered the girl.
You're a friend of hers?
Yes. At least, we were together at training command. We studied together sometimes. Brilliant tactician, and a nice person too. I don't think she ever said half of what people say she said.
Perhaps not.
But Admiral Hornan says I should stay away from her. She's poison. And Cassie Ferrati claims she was saying all sorts of things in the academy. But why they listen to Cassie, I can't figure out.
Cassie?
Classmate of ours. She's from a colonial world too, one of the Crescent Worlds groups, can't remember which. Tell you the truth, before I met her, I had heard the women there are, well, shy. Cassie was an education in that respect.
Oh?
Well, junior year. I mean, I'd heard about her, and she said she liked me. I suppose she did, as long as it lasted.
She likes men.
She likes sex. Sorry, Sarah, but it's the truth. She went through our class like...
a wildfire? And now she's always with that Ensign Serrano, isn't she?
Poor kid won't know what hit him. I'd heard she was after bigger game, working her way up. But maybe she thinks the Serrano name's better than rank alone. And right now, when they're under a cloud, what with Lord Thornbuckle being so angry with them, she probably thinks she has a better chance.
She is attractive. And I suppose she's efficient in her work?
I suppose. I was never on the same ship.
I wonder if Ensign Serrano is actually taken with her.
It wouldn't matter. She has her ways, has Cassie.
A few days downside, working through the civilian databases and Ansible, gave her even more insight into the Sweeza controversy. She had identified 5 classmates, including the sleek blonde Ferrati, who were actively spreading, if not inventing, wicked Sweeza stories. All 5 were at least one promotion group behind Sweeza. If that wasn't the green-eyed monster, she didn't know what was. Sweeza's former co-workers and commanding officers, on the other hand, seemed incredulous that anyone would believe such stories. One and all, they insisted that if she had had an argument with Brunn Meager, and if she had been insulting, then Brunn must have deserved it. Marta wasn't sure about that. Couldn't be until she met Esme Sweeza in person. But she was willing to swear that whatever the nature of the original offense, malice and envy and spite had blown it out of all proportion.
Ah.
The pains started at night. Brunn woke up to find herself knotted around her hardened belly. It eased, but she knew at once it was not a cramp from supper. It was what she most feared. She lay back, stretching a little. She was just dozing off when another pain curled her forward again. She had no watch, no clock. She had no way to tell how the pains quickened. She had to use the toilet suddenly. Levering herself out of bed, she went into the corridor. Down the length of it, she saw the glint from the door guard's eyes watching her.
Damn him!
Brunn struggled toward the toilets, but another pain caught her, doubling her up against the wall. Through a haze of pain, she saw the guard stand up, move toward her. The pain eased. She leaned on the wall, but went on into the toilet room.
At least they have toilets.
She was hardly a meter from the toilet when fluid gushed down her legs, hot and shocking.
Ew!
It was the warden. The guard must have wakened her.
Come on! Wake up, all of you! Wake up!
The woman grabbed her arm, pulled. Brunn doubled up again. The woman tugged at her arm. But it hurt too much. She was too weak. She sagged to her knees, gasping. It was unfair that she couldn't scream, unfair that this pain could not be met as it should be, with the protest it deserved. Now the other women were around her, tugging and pushing, but she huddled there on her knees, unwilling to rise. Suddenly, the warden stuck something under her nose, an acrid smell that made her throw her head up to escape it. With a grin of triumph, the woman yanked on her arms again. With the other's help, she got Brunn up, and together they half-dragged, half-carried her down the corridor and into the birthing room. By then, the pain had eased, and Brunn clambered onto the birth bed herself.
Might as well.
To her surprise, the rest of the birthing went faster than the one she had watched.
Aren't first births supposed to be slower?
She couldn't remember. She couldn't think. One pain after another flowed down her body, pushing, pushing. The other women wiped her face with damp cloths, stroked her arms. The warden waited with a folded towel for the baby that was surely just about to come. And then it did. With a last wrenching pain, she felt the pressure ease suddenly.
Ah, too little. You have puny babies.
But then another pain struck, and Brunn curled into it. The warden handed off the first baby to one of the other women.
Ah, two babies. Good.
The warden put the babies on Brunn's chest.
Give suck.
Brunn had no idea how until the warden turned the babies and pressed Brunn's nipples into the little mouths. She turned to the other women.
Help her!
The warden herself washed Brunn while the others cleaned the room. By afternoon, Brunn was back in her own room, lying exhausted on her bed with a baby on either side. She felt nothing for them. They were no more her babies than... any stranger's baby. Less. They had been forced on her. Strangers had made use of her body to produce them.
Two babies!
Brunn slid into darkness on that thought.
No breeding for half a year. You feed your babies. You help with the work here 1 month. Then you go to the nursery. Nursery for 5 months. Maybe with twins 6 months. Then to the breeding house.
Half a year.
She had half a year to get strong, to escape, to find a way to contact someone who would let her father know where she was. But in the days after the birth, Brunn began to despair again.
How can I help Hazel if I can't find her? How can I find her when I can't ask questions?
She lay motionless until the warden prodded her to get up. She fed the babies only when ordered, ate only when ordered. She didn't notice when someone took the babies away, bringing them to her only for nursing. Someone had to put them to her breasts. Someone had to clean them, and her, when they soiled her. Then one day, a cooler wind blew through the doors and windows, carrying with it a scent of harvest fields, and something familiar. Oak leaves, stubble fields. Hunting, if she were home. All at once, the full memory hit her. Opening day, with all three hunts gathered before the big house, the clop of the horses' feet, the panting and whining of hounds, the clink of glasses, the voices. But even in imagination, she saw herself silent, unable to reply to the greetings. She saw the faces of friends staring at her, shocked, disapproving. And she was standing barefoot on the sharp gravel, all the others on tall horses, hard-hooved horses stamping near her bare feet. She would never be home. Her thoughts slid down the same spiral of depression, but this time stopped short of darkness.
No!
She was young. She had a long life to live. Lady Cecilia had survived without a voice, and she had been blind and paralyzed as well. Help had finally come. She, Brunn, had been part of that help. Somewhere, people were trying to plan help for her. She had to trust that, believe that her family and friends would not leave her here forever alone. She had survived so far. She had borne twins with no medical care worth mentioning and lived. She would live to hunt again. She would ride, she would speak, and those who had silenced her would listen. Her head came up. The warden came to pat her on the shoulder.
This is good. Many mothers feel sad after babies, especially twins. But now you're better. Now you'll be all right.
She was not all right, but she could be. Perhaps. Brunn fought the darkness back, made herself begin to live again. The next day, she reached out for the babies as they were brought to her. She didn't even know what they were. Not only whose, who was the father, but whether they were boys or girls. She looked. Boys. Both boys. One with pale orange hair, one with darker, thinner hair. She could see nothing of herself in either one, and she knew that one of the men had had red hair and a shaggy red beard. She still felt nothing for them, not even the mild flicker of interest she used to feel for other women's babies. She had thought babies amusing at times when they were older than this and had learned to smile. She had felt the odd pang of tenderness, but not now. These were just little animals who had lived in her flesh and now fed at her expense. She watched the other women with their babies. They spoke to them in hissing whispers and little clicks whenever the warden was far enough away. They peered at each other's babies, smiling and nodding over them. And the same with her twins. She could not reciprocate. Now that she could force herself to her feet again, she was expected to help with the work. But she had never cared for an infant, let alone in these primitive circumstances. The wrapping of diapers baffled her completely.
It's as if she never did anything until now. Can you believe a grown woman not knowing how to peel vegetables? To put a child to breast?
I have pilot's licenses on half a dozen worlds. I can ride to hounds with the Greens. I can take down and reassemble the scan systems of a medium cruiser as fast as any technicians.
She's an abomination. Of course the heathen don't teach their daughters properly.
That was the warden's explanation for everything she did wrong. Scraps of history Brunn had hardly listened to in class floated up from a retentive memory. There had been other societies which resisted making life easier for women, because then they might turn away from the traditional role of wife and mother. Way back on old Earth, cultures which didn't let women drive ground cars or fly or learn to use weapons. Others which forbade women to teach in mixed classes, to become doctors. But that was long ago and very far away. And this was here and now. In the quick glimpse Brunn caught of the street when she and the babies were transferred to the nursery, she could not distinguish any landmarks. It was a chill, raw day. She shivered in the wind that whipped down the street. She was put in the back of the same kind of closed ground car, where she could see nothing of her route, and driven some incalculable distance with four definite turns. The front of the nursery looked slightly more welcoming, with shuttered windows instead of blank stone overlooking the street. Brunn looked up to see the obvious plume of a shuttle launch in the distance.
Eyes down!
The driver slapped at her head, but she exulted. She knew now where the spaceport was, or at least what direction.
Come inside, out of the cold.
Inside, Brunn could hear women's voices in the distance.
Women's voices?
The matron led her to a room large enough for a bed, two cribs, and a low, wide chair with a leg rest that was obviously intended for nursing. She had a small closet, a chest, and the inevitable sewing basket was on a bedside table. The matron helped her settle the babies in their cribs, helped her make the bed, and then led Brunn off to show her the house. An upstairs sewing room had rear-facing windows that looked out on a long, walled garden full of fruit trees. A few apples hung from some of them. Beyond the wall, Brunn tried not to stare, told herself she would have time to look later. Beyond the wall, she could see a street and the buildings across it. And beyond, more buildings, open land, rough fields, and distant hills. The women in the nursery had slightly more freedom. They were encouraged to walk out in the orchard, as well as do the housework and cooking. Not all the women were muted, either. They had come, Brunn learned, from other maternity homes or from private homes. Servant women whose children would be reared elsewhere when they returned to their duties. The women who supervised them inspected the babies and mothers daily for cleanliness and any sign of illness, and supervised the preparation of household chores and cooking, but otherwise treated their charges with pleasant firmness. The muted women had perhaps less pleasantness and more firmness, but no active unkindness. They continued to teach Brunn the skills they thought all women should have. Brunn had not known that such things were possible, but she watched the other women produce socks and gloves and mittens from several wooden sticks and balls of fuzzy yarn. She was handed a pair of sticks and shown, over and over, how to cast on, how to knit a plain stitch. It was the most boring thing she'd ever done. The same little movement of the hand over and over and over, even worse than sewing seams. Then they handed her another stick and taught her to knit a tube. Something clicked in her mind. This sort of thing, done with finer yarn and on a machine, made some of the things she'd worn. Sweaters, for instance. Three tubes sewn together. Stockings, leggings, tubular knits. It was interesting in an intellectual way, one of the few things that was. It got colder and Brunn shivered. The other women, warm in their knitted shawls and sweaters, shook their heads at her.
You better work faster. You'll be cold if you have no winter clothes.
In winter, they explained, they wore long knitted stockings under their skirts, held up with a peculiar arrangement of straps and buttons. The stockinged feet did not break the rules against shoes because they were not hard-bottomed. In households, some women even wore backless clogs in wet or snowy weather if they needed to go to market. But here, they would not. Here also, Brunn was formally introduced to the beliefs of her captors. They assumed that outlanders had no morals and no beliefs worth mentioning. So they began with the basics, as Brunn assumed children were taught. God, a supernatural being who had created the universe. Man, the glory of creation. Woman, created to be man's comfort and help. Evil powers, rebellious against God, who tempted woman to usurp man's position. For once, muteness had its utility. Brunn could not be made to recite the rules and rituals as the other women did, and they clearly feared contamination by anything a heathen abomination, such as a registered embryo, might commit to paper, or due to a book she read from. She was not allowed to read or write anything at all. They could not test her memory or her understanding. But she had an excellent memory. She could not hear the same words over and over without storing them away. If, in fact, you believed that women had been created as men's servants and comfort, then anything women did which was not serving men would clearly be wrong. And this was not something women could determine. Only God could make the rules, and only men could interpret them. It all made sense, except that it was ridiculous, like the ridiculous logic of paranoia. The notion that she was not as much a person as, say, her brothers was absurd. She knew that. She knew how to demonstrate that, if only she could have explained. But she was mute, all her knowledge and intelligence locked away. In her world, in the world she knew, the individual's voice was honored. She remembered Cecilia's struggles and the many who had helped her. Here, no one thought an abomination had anything useful to say. As long as she could understand and obey, that was enough. She ached, burned, to free this world's women, to show them that they were as human as men. In her mind, in the dark hours, she made all the speeches, wrote all the lectures, proved over and over and over again to an audience of shadows what she could never say. In the daytime, Brunn forced herself to walk on the gritty paths, toughening her feet as well as her legs, whenever exercise was permitted. She walked in all weathers, even when frost and snow numbed her to the knees before she was halfway to the first trees. The twins weighed her down, but she thought of them like the heavy packs in training. Additional strength would come from lugging them around. She would be stronger sooner and more able to escape. Twice a day, she walked the length of the orchard and back. Soon, she could walk farther in the lengthening days that must mean a warmer season was coming. She even welcomed the hard work of mopping and cleaning as she felt herself growing stronger. In the evenings, in her room, she attempted the exercises that had once come so easily. At first, she worried that they would notice and forbid them, but no one commented. Other women, too, she discovered, did exercises to tighten their slack bellies to recover flexibility. In the darkest times, she practiced the swift movements of unarmed combat, only two or three strokes each time in case of observation, but a little every day. She matched hands and feet against each other, the quietest way she could think to achieve the hardening she needed for a killing stroke. The showings, where proven breeders were displayed for men who might choose them next time, were less humiliation than she'd expected, and more worrying. In the showings, she did her best to look exhausted, weak, helpless, broken. It wasn't hard to look tired. She pushed herself to shaky exhaustion every day. But she could feel the muscle building on her legs again, in her arms, in her abdomen. She hoped they would believe that came from carrying the babies, from walking in the orchard, from the simple exercises the others did. But they could not expect what she intended to do with the muscles she built with such effort. Eyes squeezed shut, she reminded herself which basic moves would build the strength and speed she needed for killing. The babies were moving from creeping to rocking on their hands and knees when a new mother arrived at the nursery. She was very young and had a slightly dazed expression. The other women spoke to her in short, simple sentences, a little louder than usual. Brunn wondered if she'd been drugged, though she had seen no evidence that women were given drugs. On the third day, he approached Brunn.
"You're the yellow hair from the stars?"
Brunn nodded. Up close, she decided that it wasn't drugs, but some innate problem that gave the girl that odd expression and halting speech, and the social unawareness that let her approach the unapproachable.
"You traveled with another girl, more my size and two brats?"
Brunn nodded again.
"She said you was nice. She liked you, she said."
Brunn looked hard at the girl. She had to be talking about Hazel.
"Where did she see Hazel?"
"She's doing fine. I just thought you'd like to know."
The girl smiled past Brunn's shoulder and wandered off, leaving Brunn tethered to the twins.
"Hazel is all right. And that girl left wherever Hazel was to go to maternity. Or is Hazel in maternity?"
Brunn shook her head. She could not keep track of time. It was hot or it was cold, daylight or dark, that was all she knew. But Hazel was all right, less time ago than Brunn knew for sure. If only she knew where. Several days passed before the girl sat down beside her again to nurse her baby.
"They call her Patience now. It's a good name for her because she never makes trouble. She's real quiet and works hard. Prima says they'll be able to marry her as a third wife for sure. Maybe even second, even though she can't sew good. They've been training her for Market Girl, and she goes there by herself now."
By now, Brunn was sure the girl was retarded. No one would let her go out alone for other reasons than the restrictions on women.
"But she doesn't have your yellow hair. And she won't talk about the stars, because Prima said not to."
Brunn could have strangled her for having a voice and not saying what Brunn really needed to know. She picked up a twin and removed from his mouth the pebble he'd put there. She could not feel any affection for them, but she wasn't about to let a child, any child, choke to death. The girl petted her own child.
She don't look big enough to have babies, though. And her blood's not regular yet. The master says...
One of the women in charge came by and tapped the girl on the head.
Hush, you! You're not here to gossip about what your master says. You want your tongue pulled.
The girl's mouth snapped shut, and she clambered out of the chair, holding her baby to her. The woman shook her head at Brunn.
She's simple, she is. Can't remember from day to day what the rules are, poor thing. We have to keep an eye on her, so she don't get herself in trouble. She gets in the habit of talking about her master here, even to you. She might do it back at her house, and then they'd have to punish her. Best nip it in the bud.
She patted Brunn's head, almost affectionately.
That is purty hair, though. Might win you a chance at wifing when you're born your three. Just you give me a nod if the girl starts talking about men's doings again. Like a good girl, huh?
Brunn nodded. As long as they'd let the girl talk to her. The girl avoided Brunn for days, but late one evening she slipped into Brunn's room.
She don't scare me. I'm from Ranger Bowie's house. He's the only one can mute me. They can't. And he wouldn't, as long as I don't argue or nothing. Telling you about patience isn't arguing, it's explaining. Explaining is fine as long as it's not men.
Brunn smiled, a smile that seemed to crack her face. How long had it been since she last smiled?
I wish they hadn't muted you. I'd sure like to know what it's like out there. Patience, she won't tell me about it.
She stopped, listening, then crept closer.
I wished I had your hair.
She put out a hand to stroke it. Then she turned and vanished into the dark corridor. Brunn traced what she'd heard on the wall, fixing it in her mind, as she once would have repeated it aloud.
Ranger Bowie.
What an odd name. She didn't remember the men using any name like that on the ship. Had they even called each other by name? The nondescript man in the checked shirt bellied up to the bar and ordered. Beside him, two men were talking about the captain's choice of policy.
Well, we're free men, but I don't see any call to stomp on an anthill. It's my right, but I'm not stupid enough
to... You calling the captain stupid?
I'm saying that taking Outlander women for our own needs is one thing, but taking that one and then bragging about it is just asking for trouble.
It proves we're strong.
One turned to the man in the checked shirt.
What's your opinion, brother?
I heard she had yellow hair.
Everybody knows that. They're hoping she'll put her hair on her babes.
Someone down the bar leaned forward.
You talk about that gal from space? The yellow-haired slut? She had twins, did you hear? One redhead, one dark. Odds on, they're double-fathered. No. I'd bet on it. She won't be out for another 2 months, though. They say the twins need her milk longer, being smaller. Oh, I'd hoped.
The other men looked at each other, sly grins twitching their mouths. This one probably had only one wife, and her homely as a mud fence.
Well, who wouldn't? Don't get that many blondes, do we? Put your name on the list is all I can say. They're showing her now, if you want to see if it's worth the tax.
Believe I will.
Crockett Street Nursery.
The nondescript man in the checked shirt was not the only one who wanted to see the outworlder blonde mute who had birthed twins. They'd been confirmed fraternal and double-fathered, which meant she might throw twins again. A woman who could drop two eggs at a time was even more desirable. At first, he wasn't sure. He had been shown pictures, moving and still, of Brunn in childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. Close-ups, distance shots, everything. He had thought nothing could disguise her. But the yellow-haired woman before him was not the same Brunn, if it was Brunn at all. Her slender strength was reshaped now, her body blurred and broadened with the children she'd carried, her breasts heavy with milk. She stood heavily, arms hanging by her sides. Her yellow hair was long, lank, nothing like the lively, tousled curls in the pictures. Her blue eyes were duller, almost gray. But his practiced eye noticed what was not concealed. The bone structure of her face, her shoulders, the exact shape of her fingers and toes. This had to be the woman he sought. He looked for the RE tattoo, but the short wrap such women were allowed during a showing covered the area where it might have been. Two guards stood with her, their staves held to prevent the men from touching her.
Devil's own.
Satan's snare. Good thing they muted her.
Yep, but the babies look strong.
The babies were on display as well, naked cherubs in a playpen. They grinned toothlessly at the watching men. A black-haired man stood up, pushing his way past the others.
Not worth it to me. I'm not risking my soul for that.
There speaks a man without the tax. She was just as wicked before he looked at her.
And it's our duty to convert the heathen. I reckon another couple of birthings will convert her.
What? You bid for her wifing?
Might do. Might do worse.
Might do better.
They chatted on. Brun stared past them.
Why doesn't she lower her gaze the way the other women do? She's neither virgin nor wife, and the worst has happened already.
The man in the checked shirt shivered. And the man next to him glanced over.
What is it, brother?
Nothing.
Hazel's duties as a servant required her to go into the street each day with the garbage. When she had demonstrated that she would perform this task exactly as directed, looking neither to right nor left, even when unaccompanied, Prima decided to try her out as a market girl. She was still clumsy in her sewing. She would be more marketable for other skills. So, first in the company of Mellow Tongue, Hazel went to the market to carry home those items which the garden did not produce. She was required to look at the ground 2 paces before her and carry the basket at waist height and speak to no one, not even if spoken to. Mellow Tongue answered those inquiries which must be answered. Hazel performed exactly as ordered on that and all the trips that followed. The first time she was sent out alone, for just one item, she was watched from a distance by one of the other servant women, one too senior to be a market girl, but reliable in her gossip. She went directly to the correct stall, waited with head down until the stallkeeper called her house name, and held out the basket and payment without looking up. She was sent again, and then, in company with the head cook, learned to haggle respectfully with the stallkeepers. She took nothing on herself, she pilfered no treats, she was submissive even to the unfair scolding of the cook on the matter of some wilted greens. So, in a few months, she was sent regularly to market on market days. And there, by keeping her ears stretched to the fullest, she heard gossip about the yellow-haired outlander, the heathen woman who was in the maternity house, and then had birthed twins, and then nearly died of the birth sadness, and then moved to the nursery. Days later, she heard witch nursery. Days after that, one detail after another trickled into street talk. She said nothing. She asked no questions and told no tales. When the market girls from other houses tried to make friends with quick murmurs, she ignored them. Hazel kept her eye on Brandy, now Prudence, and Stassi, now Serenity. Day by day, the little girls seemed to forget their former life. Quick, bouncy, darting Brandy was still more active, but she had transferred her passion for blocks and construction toys to sewing and weaving. She was fascinated by the movement of the great looms in the weaving shed and had explained to Hazel, who could not figure out how they worked, how the rise and fall of rows of little rings would produce different patterns in the cloth. Both girls had friends their own age and seemed far more attached to the women who cared for them than to Hazel. Reluctantly, Hazel gave up the idea of including the littles in an escape. They were too small. They could not run and climb and fight. They would be obvious. No way to conceal the fact that they were children, and they had no training in the boys' world, so they could not pass as boys. Most of all, she could see that they were happy and secure, and that the women of the household liked them. If she could get away, if she could get Brun away, the littles would not suffer for it. No one here blamed children for things like that. They would be cared for better than she could care for them, Better, she suspected, than the distressed spacer's home would care for them if she did get them back to Familia space safely. And they were happy. They had lost one family, one world. She could not tear them away from another. So she waited her chance. She could live here the rest of her life. She had the knack of fitting in, she always had. But she didn't want to. She had to admit she liked the food, the beautiful garden, the sense of security, the luxury of what seemed infinite space in which to move. But here she would always be an outsider. She wanted to feel part of a family again. She missed the technology, the sense she'd had in Elias Madero, of being part of a greater civilization spread across the universe. Besides, there was the blonde lady. They had exchanged names. On the whole world, only she knew who Hazel really was, where she was from. And on the whole world, only she knew the blonde lady's name. She, Hazel, could survive here. But that lady had no chance.
Brune.
Hazel rehearsed the name, keeping it alive. Even at the time, even frightened as she had been and determined to protect the littles, she had felt a stubborn flare of rage at what the men had done to the other woman. Nothing anyone did, nothing, not ever, deserved that punishment. And Brune had done nothing any more than Hazel had. The men had been wrong. They had stolen her. And then they had stolen her voice. Hazel knew Brune would want to escape. Any woman would, who had lived in freedom. And Brune, even at the worst, Hazel sensed a burning determination to do more than survive. But voiceless, locked up as she was, with twin babies, she could not possibly do it alone. Hazel would have to figure out a way. It wasn't going to be easy. Not with babies. To herself, in the night, she rehearsed. But only in her head, never aloud, the things she knew to be really true. She was Hazel Takaris. Her father had been Roderick Takaris, on the engineering staff of the Elias Madero, commanded by Captain Lund. She had passed her G levels and qualified for junior apprentice in a competitive exam. Her pay scale had been upgraded once on the voyage. Brandy and Stassi had been Girion and Vorda's daughters, but Girion and Vorda were dead. The blonde woman was Brune. Out there among the stars was a universe where girls could wear whatever they chose, look men in the eye, choose their own careers and partners. Someday she would find it again. All the way to Sector 9 HQ, where she switched to civilian transport, Esme felt she had a fiery brand on her forehead and back, defining what most fleet personnel thought of her. She kept to herself as much as possible, trying to think how to explain to her father her precarious state in fleet. Perhaps the funeral and its aftermath would distract him, for it seemed she was, in fact, her great-grandmother's heir. Her previous visit to Altiplano had begun with pomp and ceremony. This time, she had the ceremony, but no pomp, and no news hounds. Her father met her in the inbound reception lounge. She almost did not recognize him in the formal mourning garments. He had brought one of the Estancia maids to help her into the clothes she must wear. In the ladies' retiring room, she changed from fleet uniform to the layers of white, long pantaloons under a petticoat, a short white chemise. The outer layers were all black, like her father's. Wide-sleeved black blouse, full black skirt, black brocade short vest heavily overbeaded in jet. Women's boots with the top rolled down to reveal the black silk lining. On her head, a stiff black cap sitting squarely across her brow with a rolled knob at either side. The weight of the clothes burdened her almost as much as the secrets she carried. Slowly, in a cadence old as the mountains, they walked from the reception area to the shuttle bay. She was used to being a half step behind her father, if not more. But now, slow as she walked, he would walk slower.
It's real.
She was the land bride. For no one else would her father slow his steps. On the shuttle down, he spoke briefly of the arrangements, then left her with a sheaf of old-fashioned paper. the family copy of the old rites in which her great-grandmother had lived her long life. Esme read carefully. She would have a coach, but the more she could do by herself, the better. She had never witnessed the ceremony of land bride's gifting, though she had heard others talk of it. At the shuttle field, it was just past sunset, with a fiery glow behind the mountains. By the time they were out of the city, night closed around them. Esme switched on the light in the passenger compartment and kept reading. Then her father touched her arm and pointed ahead. Esme switched the light off and peered into the darkness. On either side of the road, flickering lights resolved into rows of black-clothed figures holding candles. The car slowed and stopped. Her father handed her out. They walked slowly up to the great entrance and up the long drive, and the others closed in behind them. The house loomed, darker than the darkness around it. Then candlelight appeared from inside. The family, each carrying a candle. Esme entered a chill, dark space where normally light and warmth held sway. No fires would be kindled until after the ceremony. She walked through the house and lit one of the tiny candles in each room, a promise of the land bride's coming. Then through and out into the land bride's gift, the heart of the holding, and the place where the first land bride in her heartline had made claim long, long ago. There the priest waited for her, with the basket that held the braided coil of her great-grandmother's hair. Her great-grandmother's body had long been buried, of course, and the new pale gravestone set above it. In the dark night, by flickering candlelight, Esme led the women of the estancia in slow procession around each land bride's gravestone, starting with the oldest and ending with the latest. The men standing around the margin of the space did not follow. When the dance was done, Esme took the silvery braid from its basket and held it high, turning to show it to everyone.
She, who was land bride, is no more.
She has returned to the land and her spirit to the heavens.
Her power is released.
Esme untied the silk cord and untwisted the strands of the braid. The night wind sighed down off the mountains, cold around her legs even through the layers of clothes. Candle flames streamed sideways. A few went out. Esme untied the second cord at the top of the braid and held the loosened braid high in her open hands. A gust of wind picked up one strand, then another. She heard the next gust coming, shaking the trees around the glade. When she felt it, she leaped up, tossing the hair free, and landed in darkness, all the candles blown out.
Now is the death. Now is the sorrow born.
It had been a long life. It was a long dirge, and it ended only when the darkness crept back under the trees with approaching dawn. Light strengthened moment by moment. The priest, with his tall black hat, had turned his back to face the sunrise. The women helped Esme back through the crowd, into the curtained tent she had not seen for the darkness. Quickly, they stripped off the black vest, waistcloth, skirt, blouse, boots. Over the pure white underclothes, they helped her into the land bride's traditional outfit. White blouse with wide pleated sleeves, white skirt pinstriped in green, white doeskin vest embroidered and beaded in brilliant color with flowers and vines and fruit. And to top it all, the hat with its two blunt points, from each of which a gold tassel fell past her ear to her shoulder. Around her waist, the scarlet and purple-striped waistcloth, folded and tied precisely. In its folds, a narrow belt, to which was hung on her right hip a sickle's curved blade, its metal varicolored with age, but its edge still gleaming. On her left side, slung from a shoulder strap, she had a pouch of seed. Soft green boots, lined in yellow silk, would come later. For the first, she would go barefoot. Back outside, the risen sun streamed through the trees in long red-gold shafts. but the dew beneath her feet felt icy cold. The priest turned to face her. He raised on outstretched hands a long, sharpened stick. The men moved to stand behind him.
From night comes day, by the grace of God. And from the death of one comes the life of another, as the seed in the ground dies to live, as the grain that blows in the sun.
Esme lifted her arms in the ritual gestures.
Does any here challenge the land bride's lineage? Or is there cause she should not be wed?
The priest waited out a full count of 100. Esme counted it out in her own mind, then nodded.
So it shall be. This bride to this land, to the end of her life, or her willing gift to her heir.
He held out the digging stick. Esme strode out into the little circle of grain land kept for this purpose and planted carefully each year. Though the season was wrong and what she planted would not grow, it still felt connected to some larger ritual which would work, which would bind the land to her and her to the land. She was not sure she wanted that, but she knew what she had to do. With the digging stick, she pried up 3 holes at the corners of an equilateral triangle, pushing through the earth until they were big enough. Then, taking the old sickle blade, she laid the edge to the palm of her left hand. It hardly hurt at first, and the blood ran redder than her sash into the clods of earth that were loosened from the holes, darkening them. When it was enough, the women nodded, and she held out her hand for someone to bind in the kerchief that would henceforth be laid under the kitchen hearthstone. Esme took 5 seeds from the sack and dropped them carefully into the first hole, then the second, then the third. Her helpers came behind her, replacing the bloodied clods. By now, the smells of food had wafted across from the kitchens. With the land bride's dawn, fires could be lit and cookstoves heated. Fresh hot bread, roasted meat. Esme sat on a throne piled with late flowers as the feast was carried out to her guests.